Welcome to Biota Live. I'm Tom Bartley, and this is a continuation of the Biota podcast. For more information, biota.org/podcast. We have our first caller. I believe it's Travis.
It is.
Hello. Hey, Travis. Good to talk to you again. I had a great degree of fun a couple of days ago when we talked about the ethics of artificial life development. We need to do those kind of conversations again, I think.
Yes, that was absolutely wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great. So, as you are a seasoned veteran to Biota Live, I have some news and notes to read, and then we can get into this evening's discussion, which is actually a listener-submitted discussion. So we'll talk a little bit about what's been going on and then get into the discussion. The next episode on Saturday, the 5th of April at 10 a.m. is about creating an artificial life startup, which I'm sure is very close to Travis's heart and a number of other folks who have participated in Biota Live. So we will have another Saturday at 10 a.m. discussion. That's 10 a.m. Pacific. For folks interested in participating, I suspect there'll probably be similar numbers to the Evo grid. So if you're interested in getting involved, perhaps send me an email first, tom@noble8.com, and we can organize the call in terms of maximizing the folk that are on the call. Graytham News, there was a Graytham meeting in London on the 25th of March. Travis, have you heard anything from Justin about the Graytham meeting?
No, I have not, actually.
We have a call.
That would probably be Robert Rice, if I'm not mistaken.
Let's see. Hello, second caller.
Hey, this is Robert. How you guys doing?
Hi, Robert. Good to talk to you. So, have you heard from Justin about what happened at Graytham London this week?
No, I have not.
Okay, so there was a Graytham London meeting, and hopefully we'll hear more in future podcasts. I did get confirmation from Brian in Boston that the Biota CDs that I sent him of the podcast arrived safely, so at the next Graytham Boston, he will be giving out Biota CDs and probably giving a little two-minute presentation on what the Graytham folk in Boston can do with regards to Biota. This is the first topic that has been submitted by a listener. The listener was Gerald Culler. I'd like to thank Gerald and invite him to call in. Other folks can call in as well. The call-in number is 646-200-0640. There is a chat room, I believe, that's currently going on, so if you don't want to call the US number, you can participate in the chat that's available via Blog Talk Radio and, yeah, get involved. In any case, Gerald emailed me a couple of weeks ago, and I've collected a selection of his emails to read out about the particular topic this evening. But if you would like to be like Gerald and submit a topic for Biota Live, there is some incentive. I have four books which I'm interested in sending to Biota Live listeners willing to submit topics: The Ancestor's Tale by Richard Dawkins, I Was by Steve Wozniak and Gina Smith, Ever Since Darwin by Stephen Jay Gould, and The Oxford Dictionary of Philosophy could all be yours for submitting a podcast topic. Unfortunately, Gerald likes the podcast so much he didn't want to take any of the books. So very valiant on Gerald's part, and it gives the availability of all the books for folks that want to call in. Now, Travis, I know I mentioned this initially, but we had a great chat with regards to ethics. I know you were speaking last night. How did that talk go?
It was wonderful. It was at a local event called Mindshare that took place at the L.A. Brewery, which is an artist colony, and it was a cross-discipline event. So there was talks from – it was actually open with me with my talks on artificial life, and had a number of other talkers, some of them tech-based and some of them not. But the whole thing was really well received, and I made a lot of great connections and people who are very interested in the project. And so that was excellent and a great experience.
So in terms of the potential for Graytham Los Angeles, what's your thinking on that currently?
I'm thinking that there is a growing number of people who are finding out about the topic and gaining a lot of interest in it. I think that, you know, 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have necessarily known who to go to or to kind of invite and get involved, but that's rapidly changing as a function of my involvement with the community.
So I know I created a mailing list for you in particular with regards to Graytham Los Angeles, and if other folks who are listening to this podcast and are interested in starting a regional grey thumb but don't know where to start, the first process is probably getting in contact tom@nobleape.com with me. I will set up a mailing list for you. I will provide you Brian and Adam and the folks who set up Grey Thumb in Boston, and they're very interested and excited to get involved with folks all over the world who are interested in starting up Grey Thumb chapters. I looked at the Grey Thumb site today, and I noticed there was now a section up for Grey Thumb chapters worldwide. So if you're interested in starting a Grey Thumb in your own area, the first step is getting in contact, then I'll create a mailing list for the area and put you in direct communication with Brian and Adam and all the folk who are involved in starting up Grey Thumb Boston, and probably Justin and other folks as well who are starting up Grey Thumbs in their areas. So with this kind of community starting, Travis, what do you think your immediate need is in terms of creating a Grey Thumb LA?
I think it's mostly a function of having a proper presence to represent the group and get them involved in communities. A large part of that is kind of, piggybacking off the existing Biota and Grey Thumb websites, but I think that there kind of needs to be, to start with, an official event kind of planned for sometime in the near future, which I'm very much looking forward to putting together, and some, material put up on the web around that event, and so I could certainly use the help with coming up with some of that material.
Terrific. And in terms of folk attending your talk yesterday evening, how many of them had actually heard about the Grey Thumb movement or about Biota or these kind of things?
I wasn't able to really find anyone. It seemed to be a very new topic to them, and so that's why I was quite interested to kind of get a reaction. This isn't actually the first time I've talked about the subject before. I also spoke at BarCamp 5 in LA, which was back at the beginning of March. And again, the topic was incredibly well received. Lots of great interest from, mostly the interest comes a lot from kind of the self-starters who own their own company and are very interested in kind of leveraging some of the aspects of it for their own usage. But definitely a growing interest around it. And so kind of starting to, turn people onto that. I think what would really help me is kind of having business cards that are associated with Grey Thumb. Grey Thumb business cards that I can hand out and show people, here's how you get to the website, here's how you get involved with the podcast, here's how you can get involved with the community.
Yes, I mean, this is my idea with regards to the CDs as well. In fact, we're using Grey Thumb Boston as a kind of test group with regards to the potential of a certain artificial life conference that may be happening later this year with regards to CDs. I think business cards are one thing, but to give someone a CD gives them something that they can kind of take away and can lie around and then eventually touch a machine that will play MP3s and give them the positive feedback. So I think it's strange to me, I mean, particularly Bruce's experience with regards to Grey Thumb Boston, going to a group of people that should be very artificial life savvy in terms of the Biota community, and even in that grouping, a large number hadn't actually listened to any Biota podcasts as yet. So it's, you'd think Grace and Boston would have that immediacy with regards to the Biota podcast, but even there, there were still folks that hadn't listened to it. In fact, probably a majority by the looks of things. Now, some interesting news. I'm in the process of slowly reworking the Biota site, and I'm not sure whether it was the deadbeat dad's comment in Travis and my recent conversation, but Carl Sims got in contact with me yesterday, and I'm hoping to interview him in the near future. Carl Sims is someone who has made contact probably once or twice every couple of years over, I guess, the past 3 years, 4 years that I've been editing the Biota site. And my hope is through the Steve Grand interview in particular, that will provide a format that Carl Sims can interact with the Biota community in a kind of interview sense. It would be wonderful to have Carl Sims on in a long form or even a short form interview. So the number to call if you're interested in participating this evening is 646-200-0640. And the topic this evening is the Artificial Life SDK, dropping A-Life into games. And this came from listener Gerald Culler. So I'm going to read some of Gerald's emails. I've edited them down for brevity and also discussion topics. But this is what Gerald said. The vast majority of people paying for software today demand predictability over emergence. Very few are ready to trust emergence for important behaviours. Those that remain are typically game developers interested in providing their customers with challenges they themselves can't anticipate. While I wouldn't want to shoehorn the Artificial Life SDK into the gaming-only niche, it would be foolish to miss out on the potential market there. If it's a full-feature, robust SDK, it could go on to be used as the seed for future artificial life experimentation. Having gotten that option out of the way, I'm curious about how one would organize the SDK. The hooks for physics engines would affect the sensors and motion libraries, obviously. I'd love to hear how those you regularly assemble would organize a set of libraries like this. And he goes on to say, on the topic of the EvoGrid, I'd like to chat with Bruce about his work and current implementation. If it were an open source project, I'd be willing to work on it as a volunteer. So thank you very much, Terrell. And you're more than welcome to call in this evening, 646-200-0640. But for the folks gathered this evening, I think about the Artificial Life SDK, not necessarily in contrast to the EvoGrid, but just another means to get artificial life goodness out to the kind of broader public, and in this case, the game-playing public. Let's start with you, Robert. When I say Artificial Life SDK for game development, what springs to mind for you immediately?
Probably Spore and a game from the mid-90s called Creatures.
Right. That was Steve Grand's game, and I'm sure you've heard Steve Grand's interviews in the podcast feed.
Actually, I've missed those, I'd come across. I was just doing a little bit of research the other day, and I came across it, and I'd realized I'd completely forgotten about the game. It's been so many years, and now I'm trying to look back into it again, check out some of the historical, documents or interviews or whatever.
Certainly.
That game has been. So
now, Steve Grand is a fascinating character, and I think certainly the interview that I took with him last year was. Three separate interviews taken over a month's period. And what I wanted to dig into was his own kind of intimate thinking with regards to the initial implementation of Creatures and what contemporary artificial life developers can take away from that for ideas like the Artificial Life SDK. But I think when you say SDK to probably a wider group, they're not as necessarily savvy as the game development community about what comes with an SDK. Travis, if you were to characterize an Artificial Life SDK, how would you describe it?
Well, I think that actually, Robert and I have talked a bit about this in the past. There's been a number of ideas that we have come up with. One of the most prevalent in my mind is a SDK, which allows you to build virtual biologies or virtual biodomes in which a set of evolving circumstances reaches through a evolutionary process a stability point, which is to say that the biodome becomes in stability, where there's always the correct number, the correct ratio of rabbits to wolves, for instance. And then players can do things like come in and kill off half the rabbits, and then the artificial intelligence, the artificial life, will figure out a solution for bringing the biodome back into stability. So that's one application that we've kind of come up with for an SDK, is to allow programmers to easily and quickly build a system that reaches a stability point, no matter what kind of variations in stimuli you throw at it.
And obviously this is applicable to a wide variety of game genres. I mean, when I was assembling a list of possible game genres, I couldn't really find a game genre that wouldn't benefit from an Artificial Life SDK, as you've described. In fact, you've described perfectly my own idea with regards to what the SDK would look like. Can you think of a game genre that wouldn't benefit from an Artificial Life SDK, as you've described?
Yeah, I can think of plenty, actually. There's, the typical puzzle games or toys that do not have any sort of dynamic interaction involved within them at all, but are actually composed of a very static set of stimuli that the player must involve themselves with.
But if you look at Joe Riem's work, for example, that is with a similar kind of almost static environment, but putting in just a little bit of artificial life in terms of some of the puzzle pieces or some of the interactive components, having, as you say, sustainability elements and growth elements, add a different dynamic to the game. I mean, if you look at the classic Game of Life, that is very much based on static puzzle pieces in some regard, but you add just a little bit of artificial life likeness to it and it immediately becomes a different kind of game. In terms of other game genres, can you think of any that wouldn't be immediately receptive to an artificial life SDK?
No, I think the large majority of them would be exceptionally receptive to it. It solves a lot of problems as far as having to come up with dynamical models for dealing with the complex interaction that happens within the game.
Certainly, certainly. And for folks who are still trying to understand this in an abstract sense, contemporary games have physics, they have graphics, they have things like this. Do you see the Artificial Life SDK as being analogous to that, or do you think it's something different?
I think it's analogous in that it's middleware, right? You use a physics engine to provide a middleware layer which controls an aspect of the game. For in this case, it would be the physics. It controls the motion within a physical environment. You would apply an artificial life SDK in much the same way, where you would say, I have a system which is dynamic in nature, and I need to arrive at some sort of stability or some sort of optimal set of parameters within it, no matter what the changing environment might happen to look like.
So I know, Robert, you've been developing something like this specifically for an MMO environment over the past few years. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience developing artificial life environments in games in this kind of context?
Yeah, let me step back a little bit, though, and before I get to that, I want to hit some other points. I think, generally speaking, when people talk about artificial life, artificial intelligence with gaming in particular, most of the gamer's experience is usually not necessarily against artificial life so much as it is against pre-scripted events that kind of follow, you know, an if-then sort of thing. If you look at World of Warcraft, for example, a lot of the creatures or the monsters that roll around in there tend to follow very static paths, or they just kind of go around in circles, or they just kind of stay in one spot. And then when your character gets close enough, you trigger some type of aggressive function, and they make a beeline right towards you and attack. But it's usually very, very repetitive. They usually attack the same way. And, in some cases there are some variations, but it's extremely predictable, and it's all, again, based on, some very, very static, pre-scripted, events and decisions. I think that when we look at trying to develop some type of an SDK or something for games, whether it's an online game or, a single-player game or whatever, two different perspectives need to be taken. One is from the programmer's perspective, because, they have to kind of code all of this, and also from a designer's perspective, who may not have any understanding about things like, neural nets or whatever, but needs to be able to try to go in and either create behaviors or emergent behaviors or different types of interactions for these non-player characters without having to have a programmer hard-code in something or trying to learn a very complicated scripting language. So I think that for a successful SDK to come out, there needs to be kind of something for the programmers to easily plug in, and then also something for the designer guys to go in and be able to, make tweaks or modifications, or even, I hate to say it, but maybe drag and drop behaviors, things along those lines. For the MMO stuff that we've been working on, one of my biggest complaints about that industry as a whole is that things, from a player's perspective, instead of really leveraging the whole multi-user, collaborative experiences of the internet, the online games tend to be becoming more more generic, more copies of each other, and the gameplay is becoming more and more static and more single-player focused. So I think that, for the industry to kind of grow and evolve right now, it desperately needs something new that's not, hey, we have flashier graphics, or hey, we've got 55 billion more quests. We need something that is that evolves or changes, or kind of interacts with players on a different level. In most games, if you're walking around in the woods with your little dark elf or whatever, if there's some birds flying around or, you know, little rabbits hopping around in the bushes, chances are that you can't select them, you can't really attack them, you can't capture them, you can't influence them unless they're specifically designed to be, you know, combative or for a particular quest. So I think adding artificial life to games, not necessarily where they have to evolve and create new creatures and, you know, be very sport-like, but just adding things that act like animals and interact like animals with, you know, herd behaviors, flock behaviors, things of that nature would be tremendous. And that's something that we've been striving for. But not only that, but kind of taking things a step further. If my character is a ranger or a druid or something, why can't I go out and capture a dog and train it to do things like follow me around or fetch and retrieve objects? Or why can't I breed rats to be, you know, kind of vicious so I can, you know, let them loose on my foes? And there's so many different things and interactions you could do that would completely change gameplay, make experiences, whether in a single-player game or an online game, so much more immersive and interactive and interesting and engaging to people if we can just break out of this static scripting thing where things kind of walk around in a circle until you get close enough to attack them. So at the very core root of all of our designs, the content and story aside, we set out by trying to first develop a virtual world that had a vibrant ecology with a sense of responsiveness and growth and life and decay, and that's kind of what got us on the track of taking a very hard look at artificial life and seeing what we could do differently or how we could take existing technologies and wrap them up in a different wrapper and just take a different approach outside of the box.
So what you've described is very much artificial life as a kind of low-level organic artificial intelligence in games. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that you describe training organisms in an environment, be they rabbits or rats or wolves or what have you, dogs. And also in the discussion of kind of adaptive behavior, I mean, this is the problem with regards to scripted intelligence as well. And what fascinates me is that this is, in fact, a beautiful Venn between artificial intelligence in games and artificial life in games. And artificial life actually offers some solutions to these artificial intelligence problems through the kind of organic adaptation components that artificial life can provide and some of the algorithms. This, in some regard, is in contrast to the discussion about creating organic ecosystems where you can kill a certain number of rabbits and then, you know, the environment adapts and survives to that. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of distinction of artificial intelligence through artificial life and artificial life as an ability to create a beautiful environment that the users can interact with?
Yeah, no, I think you make a good point. There seems to be a disconnect between, at least from a designer standpoint, there's a bit of a disconnect between artificial intelligence and artificial life in games. When you say artificial intelligence, people generally think of, pathing. How does this character, get from point A to point B to attack the player or in a semi-intelligent sort of way? Or, how do my units, kind of gang up and plot out strategies to go up against the other guy? Whereas artificial life is generally seen something like, maybe sports, probably not the best example, but maybe Pokemon or something else, maybe a little more at the point where artificial life equals combining and breeding and putting out something new, but there's no real crossover between the two. And I think there should be. In one sense, getting back to my, training the wolf that you just captured, if there was, a mechanism for training it, conditioning it, with a reward function or giving a little treat every time it does what you want or smacking it in the butt or whatever, as well as being able to breed that particular dog with another player's dog to, make puppies that might inherit behaviors or some type of intelligence or statistic or whatever, I think that would be very keen. And then, too, getting into the person-versus-person, combat or arena games, again, like Pokemon, it's one thing if there is very static A plus B always equals C types of evolution for new creatures. But if those creatures are already pre-designed from a template by a designer previously, that kind of takes out half the fun. I think the unpredictability of being able to breed and kind of see what results not only has incredible educational and fun value right there alone, but putting that into the context of a larger multi-user sort of environment would be very interesting. And then too, if we can extend beyond just character and creature, artificial life, artificial intelligence, into, as I mentioned earlier, trying to bring in the overall ecology. What happens if you kill too many of these, or if there's too many of these populating? That should in turn affect the natural resources, which should in turn affect population growth, which should affect markets and trade routes. And there's some very, very complex systems that can be built that would introduce a lot of new emergent gameplay, all by starting at the very core of trying to build in environments that can change and be kind of evolve on their own to some degree.
Certainly. So Travis, from what Robert has said and from what I have said, do you see the Artificial Life SDK as fundamentally solving these two problems, one with the organic environment and one with an organic version of artificial intelligence?
Yes, I absolutely do. There's a lot of potential to address both problems at the same time, because you can apply the evolutionary model to both problems, where you have a set of parameters which need some sort of optimization, or you have a set of learning parameters which need to be memorized. In either case, evolutionary processes and, in turn, an artificial life SDK for games would ideally be really well suited to do this. And I've already, kind of mapped out with Robert sort of a number of models for accomplishing these types of tasks.
So this raises an interesting question, and certainly, as I've said in previous Biota Lives, when I'm contacted by folks at THQ and folks at EA, typically in the kind of middle to senior management layer of those particular companies, they always say to me, this Artificial Life SDK is a no-brainer. We need it. We've needed it for years. The players are getting smarter. The players are getting bored with, as you say, scripting and these kind of things. What do you both, and I'll start with Robert, see as being the resistive forces stopping an Artificial Life SDK currently?
A couple things. First, and I'm not a programmer by any means, so feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that, for at least for a single-player game, artificial intelligence, artificial life, whatever, it becomes in a question of, computer cycles, how much processing it's going to take to do this versus some basic, scripting and if-then statements. A lot of emphasis is usually placed on the graphics, and as the new generations of games comes out, people have to continually upgrade the processor, upgrade the memory, upgrade the video card, just to keep up with the graphics. Never mind, things running in the background to make the games more smarter and more intelligent. So I think that's challenge one. I think though, on an online game perspective, that may not be such a case, because I think that a fair amount of the processing can be shoveled off into a server and take care of that way. So that's number one. Number two, I think that while a lot of people say, artificial life, wow, it's awesome, it looks cool, it's a no-brainer for games because, we change everything and make things a lot more fun, I think that maybe it's just middle management, or maybe it's just game industry people as a whole haven't quite put their brains around what exactly that means or how to actually leverage that within games. There's, when you go to some of the conferences or the trade shows, there's not a whole lot of tracks, or it's just not very much on top of people's minds or tongues, and they really haven't sat down and thought about it. So I think that if you gave me five game designers or programmers from different companies in the same room, and we set them down and say, what do you want out of an A-Life SDK? I think most of them would say, we want it, but we don't quite know what we want in it or what we need it to do. What can the technology do? How can you show us something so we can kind of get a mental picture? So I think there's this certain amount of education that might need to go on, or one or two games, even if it's just sample demo games that really show off some of these concepts, and then suddenly all the light bulbs will go off, and then designers will be demanding the SDK, the programmers will be frothing at the mouth to get their hands on it, and then that creates a strong desire or need for upper management to start allocating resources and then trying to rethink some of the game plans that they have. And it's one last point. Most game developers, or particularly the larger they are, especially, there's always going to be a resistance to change or new ideas. A lot of times they'll say, this game was successful, so let's copy it and give it a facelift and then, you know, rebrand it, and then we can compete with these other guys. Which is why when a game comes out and is super successful, you see a lot of clones come out immediately following. In general, publishers and larger developers are very risk-averse, and they're not very acceptable towards innovations or untested ideas. So, you know, something like Spore, I think, is certainly the example because there were some, you know, pretty high-powered people, new names behind it. But, you know, for a smaller studio or even a middle-sized studio to say, hey, we're going to go in a completely different direction and create this cool, wonderful new thing, what do you guys think? The first question out of an upper management is going to be like, well, what else has been like that and has been done before, and, you know, show us where we can guarantee that this will sell this many units. So I think that there's some challenges. They're not insurmountable, but it might take one or two example games out on the market to already use the technology before something like an SDK would be commercially adopted.
Certainly. You raise a number of interesting points. Travis, in addition to the points that Robert has made, can you think of any other reasons that game development companies would be resistive to an artificial life SDK?
I think it's a lot of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I definitely like to echo kind of Robert's statement. Robert has coined a phrase before, which has been adopted as Rice's rule of funding, which states that all the money goes to all the wrong people all the time. And this is very much kind of an endemic in the game industry, a function of the large people not willing to take risks, not willing to break out into new areas, wanting to make safe bets. It's sort of like the movie industry, where they keep on making the same movie over and over. They keep on making the same MMO over and over again, because they know how to make money doing that. Whereas nobody's come to them and said, hey, if you had an artificial life SDK, you could make a ton more money doing it this way, and here's the reasons why. And so there's very much kind of that perception barrier of, first of all, the technology has been around for 30 years. Evolutionary computation got invented back in the 70s, right? But it kind of got dropped and it got forgotten about for a while there. And it's like the comment you made. It doesn't have the industry doesn't have founding fathers. It has deadbeat dads. It has no one to carry the charge and to, you know, bring those types of technologies into their sights and into the realm of importance for them. And so there's kind of a chicken and egg problem happening here. And that's one of the things that Robert and I are kind of focused on is, you know, bringing about those technologies and bringing them to the developers and to the masses, showing them the opportunities that exist within them.
So if I can talk to some of those points, Chris Hecker is a well-known game developer, and I remember seeing him speak at SIGGRAPH 99 and appeal to the broader academic and intellectual community to start providing ideas to game developers, such as an artificial life SDK. Somewhat ironically, Chris now works, I think, at Maxis with Will Wright. He worked on Spore, certainly. And he's been someone who's been a strong advocate for game developers to reach out to communities like the artificial life community. Certainly, the correspondence and the discussion that I've had with folks at EA and THQ has always been along the lines that artificial life developers themselves should create the killer app, the game that tests it out, and once they have a large community support, then, you know, extract this goodness into an artificial life SDK that can be provided to the game development community. What I find interesting is the analogy between computer graphics in games. And certainly what happened in the history of computer graphics in games is, as Robert said, folks, once a couple of, you know, good 3D graphics games were out there, a number of companies tried to copy it, and they got the secret sauce a little bit wrong. So there's this kind of organic component initially in 3D games, where the companies that got it slightly wrong failed in the short term and either rejoined the line or failed to survive. with regards to artificial life concepts, and this goes back to Chris Hecker, the real problem that the artificial life community has had is with regards to the rip-off of the seed idea, the rip-off of the engine, the rip-off of the background concept, the rip-off of the fundamental organics. And it's a pity Jeffrey Ventrella couldn't make the call this evening, but Jeffrey is the poster child for that. And the problem with Chris Hecker's analysis and the feedback that I've always given to folk about it is that the game development community, through its kind of Hollywood-style model in terms of the way things are constantly being produced and then ripped off and then, you know, everything is basically back-referential to previous games, the kind of intellectual property nurturing that the artificial life community requires in terms of back-referencing, understanding, oh, that's based on, you know, Jeffrey's work, and here's how we can utilize components of that, and let's get Jeffrey involved in the conversation. The game development community isn't on the same page in that regard. They are very much about production, putting out titles quickly, and making sure that these titles then, you know, go on into other titles. And the things that we do here with the Biota community and the things that the artificial life community does in terms of community nurturing doesn't really exist in the game development community, and this has been the difficulty of the liaison up until now. This raises a number of interesting questions with regards to whether an artificial life SDK is fundamentally the responsibility of a company, perhaps an artificial life startup or perhaps an existing games company that's receptive to the very unique components of artificial life development that could kind of father in this kind of project in some regard, or whether it could actually be developed with the kind of existing open source methodologies that haunt, perhaps is the wrong word, but are relatively indicative of the current artificial life community. I know, Travis, you have particular views with regards to this, but if we can start again with Robert, do you think this is something that necessarily needs to be part of a corporate entity, or do you think it could be done through open source?
I'm a big fan of open source, and there's been plenty of very successful things that came out of the open source community, so I think that would be fine. Putting on my business hat for a minute, I start feeling like a pirate, and I'd love to, own whatever software SDK that I was involved in developing. But I think in this particular case, one of two things needs to happen: either A, some very committed developers need to come together and get it started and do it as an open source project, or a very small developer should come together and try to get a reasonable amount of funding and then do it the right way. I think as soon as the bigger companies, and particularly the publishers, start coming in, it's all about a question of ownership and copyright and trademark and intellectual property and patenting and how do we maximize our revenues from this and lock everybody out. And I hate to say it, but a lot of these larger companies, and you would think that particularly like the entertainment industry or whatever, getting credit for your work is important and it's fair. And if there's issues or concerns, as it is now with artificial intelligence or artificial life, pioneers or forefathers or whatever that have contributed work and rightly should get some kind of crediting, there needs to be a very strong hesitancy towards dealing with larger publishers. It's not uncommon for somebody to work on a game in any capacity, from lead designer or engineer all the way on down to a low-level artist. But if they get fired or laid off, even a month before a game gets published, it's not uncommon for a larger publisher to immediately strike that person's name from the credit list. A little bit of Googling around, and you can find a lot of horror stories about people that have spent a lot of time developing things and not gotten any credit or recognition for it at all. I would be hesitant towards working specifically with, the bigger the company, the more slightly unethical they tend to be. So I would totally go with a very small group of people, whether it's open source or small developer. I think that's the best way and would yield the best results for both the industry and for the creators.
Yeah, I certainly want to echo that. I mean, my experience working through the Flow situation with Jeffrey disgusted me fundamentally, because here was a group that was saying, this is something that is completely new, completely novel, so exciting. And for me, looking at it, and particularly with the close connections between Jeffrey's work and Genova Chen, I thought they're just missing the point here. And I think the community is small, and as Travis said a couple of days ago, highly vibrant, but also needs very fundamental support in terms both of recognition, but also bringing new folk into the community. Now, outside the artificial life community, whilst I have tried to evangelize Jeffrey's work as being connected with the likes of Flow and things like this, people are genuinely ignorant of that, and certainly even little things like Steve Grand's work with regards to creatures and these kind of things. The interlinking of the artificial life community into the games community has never been relatively easy. With regards to what Robert described, what's your feeling in terms of whether a commercial entity is needed in order to harbour this work, or whether open source could be the way that this work got into the games community, Travis?
Well, I think that there, like any good open source project, there's room for a hybrid model. Red Hat, MySQL, all of these are open source models which have a commercial entity backing them. And the idea here is that you cannot put the knowledge genie back into the bottle. So your best bet as a corporation is actually to have the community at large help you understand what it is that you're trying to build and continue to build it out, and then a commercial entity can come and provide additional services on top of that in form of expertise in the matter, and providing very specific and proprietary implementations for these open source concepts.
So this is the open source model where you sell the support and additional development for the original open source project.
Absolutely, that's correct.
So in terms of the relatively oil and water aspects of the existing artificial life community and the existing game development community, what stops, I remember talking to Justin, I believe it was in one of these live conversations, what stops a bigger company from just completely ripping that off, as is the nature with regards to contemporary game development?
Well, hopefully the GPL does, right? That is why the such open source licenses exist. If the company comes and takes an open source product and then modifies it and uses it for commercial gain, they are held by the GPL to in turn re-release that work back into the community. And so this actually protects the original developers of the code from that very prospect.
Do you have any existing examples with regards to this being done?
Certainly. The Linksys WRTG router is completely based on open source, a modified open source Linux kernel. as a result of Linksys and Cisco creating this router, the community discovered this fact and said, wait a minute, that's our code in there. You need to release to us the modifications that you may have made to our code. And sure enough, they did. And if you get on the EFF, the Electronic Freedom Foundation, or look up any of Lawrence Lessig's work, this has been very much what he has been devoted to, is upholding these ideas of copyleft and some rights reserved.
I mean, certainly my own dealings with the EFF historically and contemporarily indicate that the contemporary EFF is very different to the original EFF in this regard, and certainly through my own interactions, I know of a number of cases where companies have broken various aspects of open source licenses and not been in any way upheld by the likes of the EFF or other organizations. I think the concern in the kind of broader development community, the broader open source development community, is that the examples with regards to actually holding companies to open source licenses are relatively flimsy, particularly when you look at the way that companies like Red Hat and other commercial open source companies can pay off various people in the open source hierarchy in order to allow through various problematic issues in terms of selling components of the code and things like that. So I think the problem associated with open source versus commercial software with regards to intellectual property rights in general. So the Linksys example is one of explicit code plagiarism. In fact, it's a case where you just compile it and compare the binaries. But there are other ways that open source utilities can be rewritten and released commercially. I think the concern of folks such as Steve Grand, to return to the creatures development with regards to open source, is that he has never seen personal protection associated with the open source model. This is the great irony, which I've been able to progressively convert Jeffrey Ventrella from, is that the open source model, in fact, does exactly the opposite. It gives complete control to the developer, but there is still this open component that could be potentially ripped off. Is it a matter of educating the game development community that if they utilize this resource, that they have to be respectful of the resource in some regard, or is that just purely an idealistic narrative on my part? Roberts, what's your thinking on this problem?
No, I think it's doable. I think in the past, you know, five to 7 years or so, there's been, you know, open source, at least in the game industry, has become a little bit more and more prevalent. If you look at the independent game developer community, there's a lot of open source tools like the Ogre 3D rendering engine, for example. And you know, very strong communities tend to develop and build around these sorts of things. And I think that if a larger commercial entity were to come in and kind of, you know, just start ripping out code left and right and being very unethical about it, that there's a stronger chance for a community backlash than there might have been, multiple years ago when this is all kind of sort of new and people are still trying to feel out the model. So I think that there's, I don't want to say there's a moral thing to it, but I think there's a point now where it's very bad form to do something inappropriate with open source code, and it can easily backfire. But adding a slightly amusing note, Travis, this might be a question for you as an engineer. What about, black boxing or protecting certain aspects of the code to kind of maintain, I don't want to say a secret kernel, but kind of, you know, setting up some sort of box or something that would keep people from, you know, over-leveraging it, or even, you know, telling people, hey, you know, this is AI and AI life stuff. We've got an evil intelligence stuck into this thing. If you don't pay your fees, it'll get out and, you know, do bad things.
Well, I think that the model to turn to for this is very much digital rights management and the failure of that. Any system which a human can engineer, another human can eventually reverse engineer. And so
Wait. When you say digital rights management, do you mean like software-based or getting back to the old, dongle days?
I'm talking about just kind of the concept in general of trying to keep information, keep a secret proprietary, or keep a piece of information proprietary by assuming that if we only give them binaries, they won't be able to figure out how it works. Or if we only give them access through a website, they won't be able to figure out how the back end works. I think through observation and reverse engineering, any system that a human can build can in turn be unbuilt or reverse engineered by another human when given sufficient access to it. And so I think it's a bit of a naive approach to things to say, well, it's kind of like, you know, NVIDIA saying we're only going to release binary drivers for our GPUs because we don't want to show how our GPUs really work. Well, this really didn't work out for them. They've actually had to very recently reverse that decision and say, no, in fact, we are going to open up our architecture because we found out that it is, in fact, better to have the developers on our side and working with us than trying to undo the work that we're doing.
So with 10 minutes remaining, with some discussion about Spore, the interesting thing with Spore is that Will Wright hasn't referenced artificial life at all. In fact, he went to... I can't think of the name of the Scandinavian group, but the group of folk that did vector evolving line art and things like that at the start of the game. My mind's gone blank with regards to the name of the group. In terms of Spore as an example, I've certainly in my discussions with Brian and other artificial life developers out of the podcast, I've said that we should kind of collectively hijack the launch of Spore with regards to our local communities and possibly even large portions of the online community and say, hey, wait, this is actually an artificial life game. And if you're interested in seeing other examples of artificial life, get involved with the community. In terms of using Spore as a positive leveraging for an artificial life SDK, if Will Wright himself doesn't say it's artificial life, Robert, do you think the artificial life community can kind of hijack it as an artificial life project?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's very much similar to an event like, well, I mean, because of the amount of publicity that sport has gotten already and the huge, you know, groundswelling of anticipation for it, it's akin to some degree to, you know, launching a new space shuttle or something. It draws a lot of attention to it, and it, you know, it becomes a topic in everybody's tongue. And, you know, now I've heard that they have a demo of it running on an Apple iPhone already. So there's, you know, while that topic is on everybody's mind, you know, we step back a minute and look at the game developer community's tendency to, you know, quickly copy and clone things. So if Spore comes out and all this press and you know, sells a lot of units, a lot of other game developers and publishers are suddenly going to have, you know, AI, A-Life, evolving games at the top of the list to try to emulate, which is a very good time for this community to go in and, you know, just steamroll all the trade shows, all the conferences, you know, get out there and talk about it and evangelize it. And, you know, even better if we already have some sort of SDK, whether commercial or open source, in development at Apple alpha stage or even a beta stage, because there's going to be a lot of interest that's going to ride the wave of the success of Spore. And yeah, absolutely can be hijacked.
Certainly, certainly. So with 7 minutes remaining, Travis, on the topic of the Artificial Life SDK, is there any kind of evangelism words you'd like to send out to the broader Artificial Life community?
Certainly. You know, I think that Spore is a good example of, you know, a fledgling Artificial Life game. To be fair, it is evolution on rails in that the eventuality of that evolution is a given. However, there's lots of caveats within that, such as the way that creatures figure out how to walk for themselves. They use a procedural model, which is inherently evolutionary, in that it, you know, tries different things and arrives at a solution that works for that particular creature in that particular configuration. As far as artificial life games goes, it's a great example of, you know, the type of things that really can be done when you really apply some of the concepts of evolution and biology to game design. And this definitely isn't the first. I mean, the one that keeps coming back to my mind is like SimAnt, which is a game about the emergent properties of swarm behavior. There's a lot of really good examples. I just don't think there's a lot of good examples recently for artificial life games. However, when artificial life developers are looking to get into this, I think that there's a lot to be learned from Will Wright's work specifically his approach to providing dynamic environments for the players, which they've never seen before and is unique every single time you play the game. I think that's very much one of the kind of cornerstones of artificial life, is it's unpredictable and it's dynamic and it breaks the mold of the static game.
So in terms of the EvoGrid development, Travis, do you see the Artificial Life SDK as being a separate project, or do you see it as something that may come out of the EvoGrid development?
I see it as a separate project. The EvoGrid is a transport, as I understand it, is a transport layer or an environment for which artificial life projects can live. An example would be if somebody were to take an artificial life SDK and create a game which had creatures in it, it might in turn use the EvoGrid to do things like store those creatures or communicate those creatures between games. But it is itself not actually trying to produce an artificial life SDK, at least not from what I understand.
So with 4 minutes remaining, Robert, if folks are listening to this and they want to contact you for more information about your own ideas, is your MMO book a good place to start, or should people contact you directly?
I would prefer they contact me directly. The MMO Evolution book was more about the current state of the industry and where it's going or where it could go. And this is, I guess, kind of supplementary to that. The best way to reach me is obviously via email, which is robert@neogence.com.
And Neogen is fundamentally an artificial life MMO company, isn't it?
We started NeoGens to focus solely on MMOs, but now we're taking a step back and broadening the focus to look more at taking various technologies and kind of converging them to build better platforms for MMOs or the other market sectors that have to do with virtual worlds and that sort of thing.
Great. So the topic for discussion next Saturday, 10 a.m. Pacific, how to create an artificial life startup, is obviously both very close to your works. Travis, if people are interested in getting in contact with you, how's the easiest way for them to do that?
That would be my first initial last name, T-S-A-V-O, at Verse, V-E-R-S-E, -studios.com. Verse Studios is my own game studio, and we are focused on creating social networking games, of which artificial life definitely plays a large role, because as you identified earlier, game genres in general have a lot to benefit from artificial life, and on top of that, it's just kind of a very much a professional hobby of mine.
Certainly. It's very much a professional hobby of mine as well in some regard. So I'd like to thank you both very much for the opportunity to chat with you this evening. I hope we've done Gerald some justice with regards to his topic. I know we didn't get too much down into the nuts and bolts. And Gerald, please feel free to demand a part two to this, because it's wonderful to talk to folks like Travis and Robert on this topic. And it'd be nice to have people like Jeffrey and potentially even Steve Grand call in and be a part of this topic in the future. So thank you both very much for participating this evening.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, and if I just may mention that you can also read my blog, in which I am talking a lot about artificial life and my work in it, at Ender of Games, E-N-D-E-R of Games.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Travis. I look forward to folks tuning in next Saturday. Please feel free to call in. The number will be 646-200-0640. Thank you very much.